bigger, even more monstrous nuclear weapon, one that the scientists involved called the super. Indeed, the super works better in large sizes than in small sizes, its designer, Richard Garwin, tells us, confirming for readers of this book that, yes, I am the architect of the super, of this first thermonuclear bomb. Edward Teller conceived it, Richard Garwin drew it, at a time when no one else knew how. The year 1952 saw the invention of the thermonuclear bomb, also called the hydrogen bomb, a two-stage megaweapon, a nuclear bomb within a nuclear bomb. A thermonuclear weapon uses an atomic bomb inside itself as its triggering mechanism, as an internal explosive fuse. The super's monstrous explosive power comes as the result of an uncontrolled, self-sustaining chain reaction in which hydrogen isotopes fuse under extremely high temperatures in a process called nuclear fusion. An atomic bomb will kill tens of thousands of people, as did the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A thermonuclear bomb, if detonated on a city like New York or Seoul, will kill millions of people in a superheated flash. The prototype weapon Richard Garwin designed in 1952 had an explosive power of 10.4 megatons, the near equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs exploding all at once. It was an atrocious weapon. Garwin's own mentor, the Manhattan Project's Enrico Fermi, experienced a crisis of conscience at the very thought of such a horrifying weapon being built. Fermi and colleague I.I. Rabi temporarily broke ranks with their weapons-building colleagues and wrote to President Truman, declaring the super to be an evil thing. Their words in writing. The fact that no limits exist to the destructiveness of this weapon makes its very existence and the knowledge of its construction a danger to humanity as a whole. It is necessarily an evil thing considered in any light. But the president ignored the plea to stop building the super, and Richard Garwin was given the go-ahead to draw the plans. If the hydrogen bomb was inherently evil, it's still evil, Garwin says. The super was built. Its code name was Mike. The series was Ivy. So it was the Ivy Mike test. On November 1, 1952, it was test-fired on Ilulissat Island in the Marshall Islands. The Ivy Mike prototype bomb weighed around 80 tons, 160,000 pounds, an instrument of destruction itself so physically enormous it had to be constructed inside a corrugated aluminum building 88 feet long and 46 feet wide. Ivy Mike exploded with unprecedented yield. The bomb crater left behind was described in a classified report as being large enough to hold 14 buildings the size of the Pentagon. And while there is much to say about the inhumanely destructive power of thermonuclear weapons in general, two aircraft photographs, before and after shots of the Ivy Mike bomb test, tell the story. In the photograph before the bomb test, Ilulissat Island appears as it had since its geological origin. In the photograph after the bomb test, the entire island is gone. In its place is a crater 2 miles in diameter and 180 feet deep. Scorching the earth with mass extermination weapons had just been one-upped by an order of magnitude. The invention of the super brought with it the existence of a weapon that can vanish land. What happened after U.S. war planners saw what 10.4 megatons could instantly destroy simply boggles the mind. What came next was a mad rush to stockpile thermonuclear weapons, first by the hundreds and then by the thousands. In 1952, there were 841 nuclear bombs. The next year, there were 1,169. The process became industrialized, Los Alamos historian Glenn McDuff explains. These were not science projects anymore. By 1954, there were 1,703 nuclear weapons in the stockpile. The U.S. military-industrial complex was now churning out, on average, 1.5 nuclear weapons per day. 1955, 2,422, almost two bombs per day, and with 10 new systems introduced, including three new styles of thermonuclear bombs. 1956, 3,692 bombs. The numbers continued to escalate to the point of dizziness. With production levels soaring, these mass destruction weapons were now coming off literal assembly lines at an average pace of 3.5 nuclear bombs per day. By 1957, there were 5,543 bombs in the U.S. stockpile. That is 1,851 new nuclear weapons in a single year, more than five per day. And the numbers kept growing. 1958, 7,345, and growing. 1959, 12,298. By 1960, when the U.S. war planners met in the underground bunker in Nebraska, the U.S. stockpile contained 18,638 nuclear bombs. By 1967, it reached an all-time high of 31,255 nuclear bombs. 31,255 nuclear bombs. Why stockpile 1,000 or 18,000 or 31,255 nuclear bombs when a single one of them, the size of Ivy Mike, dropped on New York City or Moscow could leave some 10 million people dead? Why continue to mass produce thousands of these weapons when the use of a single thermonuclear bomb will almost certainly ignite a wider, unstoppable, civilization-ending nuclear war? A new term was afoot, a figure of speech known as deterrence, to keep something from happening. But what does that even mean? History lesson number one, deterrence. There are rules of nuclear war that guide U.S. nuclear policy. Concepts created by war planners starting in the 1950s to allegedly keep nuclear war from happening, while at the same time allowing war planners to figure out how to fight and win a nuclear war when it comes. Rule number one is deterrence, sold to the public as the idea that maintaining a massive nuclear stockpile is imperative for the purpose of discouraging nuclear attack. Deterrence guides nuclear policy. It works like this. Each nuclear-armed nation builds an arsenal of nuclear weapons that it keeps pointed at its nuclear-armed enemy, ready to launch in a few minutes' time. Each nuclear-armed nation vows never to use nuclear weapons unless they are forced to use them. Some people see deterrence as a peaceful savior. Others see it as doublespeak, asking, how could having nuclear weapons keep people safe from having a nuclear war? For decades, deterrence has allowed the Defense Department to build tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, their delivery systems, and a complex system of counterweapons to defend against nuclear attack. Trillions of dollars have been spent on nuclear weapons. There is no way to know the total for sure, because the true numbers are classified. Rule number one alleges to be simple. Deterrence keeps the world safe from ever having a nuclear war. But what happens if deterrence fails? Chapter 4. The PSYOP, the Single Integrated Operational Plan for General Nuclear War. As the U.S. nuclear stockpile was multiplying out of control, so were each of the individual U.S. military forces' plans for nuclear war. As crazy as this now seems, before December 1960, each U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force chief had control over his own stockpile of nuclear weapons, their delivery systems, and target lists. In an attempt to rein in the potential for mayhem from these multiple competing plans for nuclear war, the Secretary of Defense ordered all of them to be integrated into one single plan, which is how the Single Integrated Operational Plan, the PSYOP, got its name. In 1960, Strategic Air Command, later called U.S. Strategic Command, had 280,000 employees. To work on this new plan, 1,300 of them were corralled into a Joint Strategic Target Planning staff, men and women whose sole job was to integrate all the individual target packages into a single target deck. This amalgamated plan is what John Rubel and his colleagues learned about that December day in the bunker beneath Offutt Air Force Base. The secret plan that, if activated, would result in the deaths of at least 600 million people on the other side of the world. This plan for general nuclear war showed how the entire U.S. military force would be launched at Moscow in a preemptive first strike. How defense scientists had carefully calculated that 275 million people would be killed in the first hour, and that at least 325 million more people would die from radioactive fallout over the next 6 or so months. Roughly half of these deaths would be in the Soviet Union's neighboring countries, countries not at war with America, but who would be caught in the crosswinds. This included as many as 300 million Chinese. In 1960, the world's population was 3 billion. What this meant was that the Pentagon had paid 1,300 people to compile a war plan that would kill one-fifth of the people on Earth in a preemptive nuclear first strike. It's important to note that this number did not account for the 100 million or so Americans who would almost certainly be killed by a Russian equal measure counterattack. Nor did it account for another 100 million or so people in North and South America who would die from radioactive fallout over approximately the next 6 months, or the untold numbers of people who would starve to death from the climate effects of a world set on fire. After the briefing was concluded, a second classified plan of attack was demonstrated, one that Rubel described in his 2008 memoir as being an attack on China given by a different speaker. It, too, involved similar theatrics with ladders and pointers and plastic sheets. Eventually, this speaker arrived at a chart showing deaths from fallout alone. The briefer pointed to a graph. It showed that deaths from fallout as time passed would be 300 million, half the population of China, Rubel wrote. After some time, the meeting was adjourned. The following morning, John Rubel participated in yet another meeting, smaller this time. It included himself, the Secretary of Defense, each of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the Commandant of the Marines. Rubel recalled that the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Lyman Lemnitzer, told everyone they had done a very fine job, a very difficult job, and that they should be commended for their work. Rubel recalled the Army Chief, George Decker, expressing similar congratulatory remarks. And he remembered how the chief naval officer, Arleigh Burke, took his customary pipe out of his jaw and repeated the same message, hard job, well done, should be commended. That the last man to speak, General Thomas White of the Air Force, ground out a comparable stream of the platitudes favored that morning in his gravelly voice, always filled with a certain air of authority. No one spoke up to object to the indiscriminate killing of 600 million people in a U.S. government-led, preemptive, first-strike nuclear attack, Rubel wrote. Not any of the Joint Chiefs, not the Secretary of Defense, not John Rubel. Then, finally, one man did. General David M. Shoup, the Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, a Marine awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions in World War II. Shoup was a short man with rimless glasses who could have passed for a schoolteacher from a rural mid-American community, recalled Rubel. He remembered how Shoup spoke in a calm, level voice when he offered a soul-opposing view on the plan for nuclear war. That Shoup said, "All I can say is any plan that murders 300 million Chinese, when it might not even be their war, is not a good plan. That is not the American way." The room fell silent, Rubel wrote. Nobody moved a muscle. Nobody seconded Shoup's dissent. No one else said anything. According to Rubel, everyone just looked the other way. It was decades later that Rubel confessed that this U.S. plan for nuclear war he participated in reminded him of the Nazis' plans for genocide. In his memoir, he referred to a time in an earlier world war when a group of Third Reich officials met at a lakeside villa in a German town called Wannsee. It was there, over the course of a 90-minute meeting, that this group of allegedly rational men decided among themselves how to move forward with the genocide in a war they were presently winning, World War II, so as to ensure total victory for themselves. Millions of people needed to die, these Reich officials agreed. Millions of them. Finally, when John Rubel was in his late 80s, he articulated key similarities he perceived between the meeting in Wannsee and the meeting beneath the Offutt Air Base in Nebraska. "I thought of the Wannsee Conference in January 1942, Rubel wrote, "when an assemblage of German bureaucrats swiftly agreed on a program to exterminate every last Jew they could find anywhere in Europe, using methods of mass extermination more technologically efficient than the vans filled with exhaust gases, the mass shootings, or incineration in barns and synagogues used until then. Nearing the end of his life, Rubel decided to tell the world what he could not back in 1960. I felt as if I were witnessing a comparable descent into the deep heart of darkness, a twilight underworld governed by disciplined, meticulous, and energetically mindless groupthink aimed at wiping out half the people living on nearly one-third of the Earth's surface. The final solution called for the extermination of all of Europe's millions of Jews and millions more people the Nazis considered subhuman. The plan for general nuclear war that John Rubel and his colleagues signed off on, the single integrated operational plan, called for the mass extermination of some 600 million Russians, Chinese, Poles, Czechs, Austrians, Yugoslavians, Hungarians, Romanians, Albanians, Bulgarians, Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Finns, Swedes, Indians, Afghans, Japanese, and others that U.S. defense scientists calculated would be caught in the crosswinds. The final solution was enacted. The PSYOP never has been, not so far, but a similar, still classified plan exists today. Over the years, its name has changed. What began as the single integrated operational plan is now the operational plan, or OPLAN. For the Nuclear Information Project, in consort with the Federation of American Scientists, Project Director Hans Christensen and Senior Researcher Matt Korda have identified the current operational plan as OPLAN 8010-12, and that it consists of a family of plans directed against four identified adversaries: Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. The number of nuclear weapons in the U.S. stockpile today is smaller than it was in 1960, but there still are 1,770 deployed nuclear weapons, a majority of which are on ready-for-launch status, with thousands more held in reserve, for a total inventory of more than 5,000 warheads. Russia has 1,674 deployed nuclear weapons, a majority of which are on ready-for-launch status, with thousands more in reserve, for a total inventory that is roughly the same size as the United States. It is precisely the effects of this kind of mass extermination plan that nuclear war, a scenario, is based upon. A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought, President Ronald Reagan and Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev cautioned the world in a joint statement in 1985. Decades later, in 2022, President Joe Biden warned Americans that the prospect of nuclear Armageddon is at a terrifying new high. So here we are now, teetering at the edge, perhaps even closer than ever before. Part 2, the first 24 minutes. 4/10 of a second after launch. Pyeongsang, North Korea. Nuclear war begins with a blip on a radar screen. It is 4:03 a.m. in North Korea, darkness before dawn. In a seemingly barren field, 20 miles outside the capital, Pyongyang, a massive cloud of fire erupts just feet off the ground. Hot rocket exhaust spews from the tail end of North Korea's powerful intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, as it launches off a 22-wheeled vehicle parked here in the dirt. The Hwasong-17, which analysts call the monster, begins ascent. Hovering 22,300 miles above planet Earth, as if floating in space, a car-sized sensor from the U.S. Defense Department's SBIRS satellite system spots the fire from the missile's hot rocket exhaust through the cloud cover. This happens within a few tenths of a second after ignition. SBIRS is a group of satellites in the U.S. space-based infrared system of satellites, and because of how it moves, it seems to linger here in space, roughly one-tenth of the way to the moon. By circling the world at precisely the same speed as the Earth turns, a satellite in geosynchronous orbit behaves as if suspended. SBIRS alarms, ballistic missile launch alert. 1 to 3 seconds after launch, Aerospace Data Facility, Colorado. Raw data from space streams down into the Aerospace Data Facility, a National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, mission ground station at Buckley Space Force Base in Aurora, Colorado. The existence of this installation, as well as its sister ground stations at Fort Belvoir in Virginia and at White Sands in New Mexico, was classified until 2008. NRO's intelligence findings are among the most jealously guarded in the United States national security apparatus. Its motto is supra et ultra, above and beyond. Everything in this facility is classified. Every bit of data handled in this office is safeguarded by a labyrinth of highly classified protocols, many of them encrypted. Information here is often flagged ECI for exceptionally controlled information. NRO's officers are highly trained. There is no room for mistakes. Aerospace data facilities are responsible for command and control of Defense Department reconnaissance satellites. They analyze, report, and disseminate information about incoming nuclear threats. Alarms wail. Ballistic missile launch alert has everyone's attention. Co-located in this facility are hundreds of National Security Agency personnel who begin sending encrypted emergency messages to three nuclear command centers located inside three separate command bunkers, each one fortified underground in three different places. The Missile Warning Center, Cheyenne Mountain Complex, Colorado. The National Military Command Center, Pentagon, Washington, D.C. The Global Operations Center, Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska. The NRO Mission Ground Station here in Colorado is the nation's primary domestic downlink facility for all U.S. military satellites. There are others, says former Chief Scientist Doug Beeson of the U.S. Air Force Space Command. This includes an organization known as DEFSMAC, the Defense Special Missile and Aeronautics Center, a classified facility located inside NSA headquarters at Fort George G. Meade in Maryland. Everything that will happen in a nuclear war when it comes hinges upon what analysts at these ground stations interpret as happening in the moment. In this scenario, that means now. 4 seconds. Space. The SBIRS geosync satellite over North Korea is roughly the size of a metro bus, with two 20-foot-long solar wings extended wide on either side. SBIRS sensors have independent tasking capabilities, meaning they are able to scan wide swaths of territory and simultaneously fixate on a particular area of concern. Sensors so powerful, they can see a single lighted match from 200 miles away. The space-based infrared system is America's 21st century version of Paul Revere. But it's not the British who are coming, not on foot or on horseback. It's a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile, the all-powerful, unstoppable, civilization-threatening ICBM. Sensors aboard the U.S. satellite systems over North Korea perform their onboard signal processing, streaming colossal loads of early warning sensor data down to planet Earth. To think, the world's first satellite was launched by the Russians in 1957, a beach ball-sized spaceship called Sputnik, with radio antennas and silver zinc batteries. Now, decades later, there are more than 9,000 high-powered, microprocessor-capable satellites circling the Earth, connecting people through telecommunication, aiding with navigation, forecasting the weather, entertaining with TV. SBIRS does none of this. It keeps guard, vigilantly waiting and watching 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for that initial explosive spark of a nuclear threat. A spark indicating an action that cannot be undone. 5 seconds. Aerospace Data Facility, Colorado. Inside the Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado, some of the fastest computer systems in the world sort raw SBIRS sensor data at a meteoric pace. They are busy measuring the dimensions of the launching ICBM's fiery plume. The hot rocket exhaust on a short-range ballistic missile differs dramatically in plume brightness and size from that on the intercontinental ballistic missile, each being precisely measurable from space. Ballistic missile launches are not uncommon. They are also increasing at unprecedented speeds. In 2021, the U.S. Space Force tracked 1,968 missile launches around the globe, a number that increased more than over 3.5 times in 2022, says Space Systems Command's Colonel Brian DeNaro. As of September 2023, Russia continues to notify the U.S. of its ballistic missile test launches. No one wants to start a nuclear war by accident. As a general rule, missile tests as significant as an ICBM launch are announced, usually to neighbors, through diplomatic channels, back channels, some other kind of channel, but almost always through a channel. The exception is North Korea. Between January 2022 and May 2023, North Korea test launched more than 100 missiles, including nuclear-capable weapons that can hit the continental United States. None of them were announced. They want to maintain the element of surprise, intelligence analyst Joseph Bermudez Jr. tells us, to reinforce propaganda that they're a mighty and powerful nation. Which is why Defense Department satellites remain parked over North Korea, to examine ICBM exhaust starting in the first fraction of a second after launch. In Colorado, plume measurements confirm what analysts are seeing, an ICBM launch out of North Korea with a trajectory that is alarming. The missile is not heading into space, as it would be for a satellite launch, or toward the Sea of Japan, a commonplace trajectory in a demonstration of power test. All critical components of America's colossal early warning system are now correlating the missile's trajectory and integrating data streams, working to characterize more precisely the exact nature of this event. Is it a provocative test or a nuclear attack? A hack or a hoax? At once, a vast worldwide network of U.S. intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets begins churning out every manner of intelligence information in the arsenal. SIGINT, signals intelligence. IMINT, image intelligence. TECINT, technical intelligence. GEOINT, geospatial intelligence. MASINT, measurement and signature intelligence. CYBINT, cyber intelligence. COMINT, communications intelligence. HUMINT, human intelligence. And OSINT, open source intelligence. All of it surging into the system in order to create an accurate picture of this detected event. Every fraction of a second matters. Every byte of information counts. 6 seconds. National Military Command Center, Pentagon. The National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon serves as the primary command and control facility in a nuclear war. It may or may not also be the target. In this scenario, it is 3:03 p.m. local time in Washington, D.C., March 30th. Early spring. It has been 6 seconds since the ICBM's launch. Computer algorithms in the National Military Command Center have already begun predicting the missile's intercontinental trajectory based on available data, but a localized target area cannot yet be accurately discerned. Is the missile headed for America? To Hawaii? Or is the target the continental United States? On any given day, at any given hour, there are hundreds of people working in this heavily fortified nuclear bunker beneath the Pentagon, each of them performing duties related to 3 primary missions assigned to the National Military Command Center in its quest to ensure U.S. national security. The monitoring of military activity and events around the world. The watching of the world for nuclear weapons activity. The ability to respond to specific crises as necessary, including the execution of the O Plan, formerly the PSYOP. Now, mere seconds after the confirmation of an ICBM launch out of North Korea, all eyes remain focused on a theater-sized electronic screen mounted on the command center's wall. On a dot moving ominously across the screen, an avatar for a nuclear-armed Hwasong-17 ballistic missile. As J-3 Operations Directorate officers pour into the National Military Command Center, the J-2 Deputy Director of Intelligence works to get a North Korean official on the line. Among the joint staff officers in the room delivering commands are the J-32 Deputy Director for Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance, ISR, Operations, 2-star General Flag Officer. The J-36 Deputy Director for Nuclear and Homeland Defense Operations, 1-star General Flag Officer. The J-39 Deputy Director for Global Operations, 1-star General Flag Officer. Not since 9/11 has everyone and their staff been in such an acute state of heightened alert. It's hard to capture and explain the fog and friction of war Colonel John Brunderman says, of his experiences in the bunker beneath the Pentagon on 9/11, a command post that functions as the top of the pyramid for all U.S. command posts around the world, a classified facility that ensures connectivity for the single integrated operational plan execution, worldwide situation monitoring, and crisis management. And yet, in the fog of war, uncertainty remains. When you're looking for things that are abnormal, Colonel Brunderman warns, a lot of things appear abnormal. 15 seconds, Buckley Space Force Base, Colorado. In Colorado, combat pilots run toward fighter jets waiting on the tarmac, ready to take to the air. 15 seconds have passed since launch, and the ICBM has traveled far enough now that satellite sensors can determine its trajectory more precisely. The outlook is catastrophic, a worst-case scenario beyond comprehension. The Hwasong-17 is traveling toward the continental United States. Buckley Space Force Base is home to Space Delta IV, the missile warning unit that operates defense satellites in space, as well as ground-based early warning radars around the world. Space Delta IV is in charge of reporting strategic warning information via encrypted communications links to three commands. NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORTHCOM, U.S. Northern Command, STRATCOM, U.S. Strategic Command. Each of these three commands has an early warning center located 80 miles down the road from the Space Force Base, inside the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, America's legendary nuclear bunker, built inside a granite mountain during the Cold War. Everyone with Space Delta IV is hyper-focused on what appears to be an attacking intercontinental ballistic missile en route to the United States of America. The dreaded ICBM is unstoppable and nuclear capable. Once launched, an ICBM cannot be recalled. Across NORAD, NORTHCOM, and STRATCOM, everyone waits for an over-the-horizon ground radar system to confirm that a nuclear-armed missile is indeed attacking the United States. This secondary corroboration is imperative. Given the missile's trajectory, the first radar station to see the attacking missile as it comes over the horizon will be Clear Space Force Station in Alaska. Their state-of-the-art machine eyes remain focused on incoming threats from the Pacific. It will take another 8 minutes or so for the radars in Alaska to see the incoming missile. To analysts here, this will feel like an excruciating amount of time as the clock ticks on an incoming nuclear missile threat. 20 seconds. Clear Space Force Station, Alaska. Clear Space Force Station in Alaska is a remote military installation strategically positioned on the outskirts of Fairbanks. In late March, the average temperature hovers in the teens. Most of the snow has melted by now. At the center of the base stands a 5-story tall search, track, and discrimination radar called the Long Range Discrimination Radar. This massive terrestrial sentinel is the newest component in a decades-old early warning radar system. Its job is to watch for missiles attacking the U.S. from the Pacific theater and to relay warnings to NORAD, NORTHCOM, and STRATCOM. From inside the structure, 2 massive 60-foot diameter antennae scan the skies 24/7, 365, in search of any indication of a missile attack. The radar system provides an extra set of keen eyes that will paint the picture of any threat coming our way, NORAD's Lieutenant General A.C. Roper explains. At 20 seconds after launch, the Arctic airmen and guardians assigned to the space warning squadrons here outside Fairbanks have received word from Space Delta IV of an attacking ICBM. But they see nothing, not yet. No amount of advanced technology can help the ground radars to see over the horizon. It's not physically possible. So the humans manning the systems must wait. The massive radar system will remain blind to an attacking ICBM until that missile is in its mid-course phase, when the nuclear payload in its nose cone will be perilously closer to striking the United States. Streams of data from ground radars feed to the command posts located thousands of miles across the North American continent, into the classified underground missile warning center inside Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. For now, the long-range discrimination radar remains deceptively calm. 30 seconds, Cheyenne Mountain Complex, Colorado. Here in central Colorado, 2,000 feet below a triple-peaked mountain of igneous rock, alarms screech, lights flash, every computer generating a classified message to indicate the dreaded nuclear launch alert. 30 seconds have passed since launch. The SBIRS satellites now have enough track data on the ICBM to determine it is heading toward a target somewhere on the east coast of the United States. Everyone in the Cheyenne Mountain Complex is alerted to the threat. Everyone is stunned by what is going on. Sensor data from space and ground radar stations around the world inundate Missile Warning Center personnel, propelling them to task. Everyone is working to characterize the incoming threat. Everyone is seeing the same thing. One single incoming ICBM. Everyone is thinking the same thing. One nuclear missile doesn't make any sense. If North Korea really is attacking the U.S. with an ICBM, it will be considered a preemptive nuclear first strike. If ordered by the president, the response from the U.S. military will be the overwhelming and unconditional use of nuclear force. North Korea will be destroyed. This kind of bolt-out-of-the-blue attack is characterized as a surprise attack, a sneak attack, former Secretary of Defense William Perry tells us. A military tactic as old as warfare itself. But in this age of nuclear weapons, it is national suicide for any country to be as foolhardy as to preemptively strike the United States. All deterrence is predicated on the idea that a bolt-out-of-the-blue attack against a nuclear-armed superpower all but ensures the attacking nation's total and complete destruction. Surprise attacks change history. But a surprise attack is designed to decapitate, to cut off the head of the snake. For that, you send the mother load of weapons. You do not send one single ICBM. Not against a country like the United States that has 1,770 nuclear weapons deployed, a majority of which are at the ready to launch. One single attacking missile would not make sense, former SecDef Perry adds, and that this kind of oddity would require additional information before the president would be told. With lights in the Cheyenne Mountain Complex flashing red, with warning sirens screeching alarm, every person in this complex acts as trained. Feet, fingers, eyeballs, intuition, all human faculties moving in ballet-like concert with their machine partners, sorting sensa data into actionable intelligence. The Missile Warning Center here in Cheyenne Mountain is a collection point for missile launch data worldwide. The people here decide whether or not to categorize the information coming in as a risk to North America and to the United States. "We are the brainstem that is pulling it all together," says Cheyenne Mountain's deputy director, Stephen Rose, "correlating it, making sense of it, and passing it up to the brain, whether it's to the commander at NORAD, NORTHCOM, or STRATCOM." The Cheyenne Mountain Complex is the brainstem that interprets data for the commanding generals and admirals to decide when and if to get the president on the line. The act of preparing a nuclear attack assessment for the commander-in-chief makes the Cheyenne Mountain Complex the most critical part of the nervous system and the most vulnerable, Rose warns. Physically, the facility can withstand direct impact from a 1 megaton thermonuclear bomb. But the vulnerability here is a theoretical one. Here, now, there is no room for error in judgment. No room for error of any kind. The fate of the country and the planet and its people is on the line. 60 seconds. U.S. Strategic Command, STRATCOM, Headquarters, Nebraska. 60 seconds have passed. Beneath Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska lies U.S. Strategic Command Headquarters, STRATCOM as it is known, a 916,000-square-foot complex of bunkers, command centers, medical facilities, dining halls, sleep centers, power stations, tunnels, and more. This $1.3 billion nuclear command center, buried several stories underground, has also been designed to withstand a direct hit from a 1 megaton thermonuclear bomb. Of the more than 3,500 people who work here, all of them are now focused on the incoming nuclear threat. "Eat, eat, eat," all classified alert systems sound. There's about 10 different ways to make sure that the commander knows that it's time to move, says former STRATCOM commander, General John E. Hyten. Ballistic missile launch alert. Electronic alert systems sound, screech, wail, blink, and vibrate all at once. It is impossible to work at STRATCOM headquarters and not know an attacking ICBM is now presumed to be on its way to the United States. The person who matters most in this moment is the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, the STRATCOM commander, as he or she is known, the nation's most senior military commander responsible for nuclear operations. More than 150,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, guardians, and civilians follow the STRATCOM commander's orders. In the nuclear command and control system, the STRATCOM commander advises the president and then follows his direct orders. There is no human being in between these two individuals. Not the Secretary of Defense, not the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not the Vice President. The duty of the STRATCOM commander comes with a responsibility unlike any other in the world. Retired General George Lee Butler, who commanded U.S. nuclear forces from 1991 to 1994, summed up his responsibility like this. Should our warning systems detect an attack on the United States? My role was to advise the president that we were under attack, to characterize it in terms of the type and number of weapons and their targets, to advise him of his options as portrayed in the nuclear war plan, to elicit an execution order, and promptly transmit it to the operational forces to ensure their timely launch, survival, and delivery of their weapons. 60 seconds into this unfolding nuclear crisis, the STRATCOM commander in this scenario exits his office and hurries into a private elevator that is his alone. The ride down into the command center's nuclear bunker, called the Global Operations Center, takes just seconds. Our strategic forces are always ready to respond, and everybody should know that, STRATCOM Commander General Hyten told CNN in 2018. They are ready this minute, under the ground, under the sea, in the air. We are ready to respond to any threat, and the adversaries of the world, including Kim Jong-un, have to know that. The elevator doors open. If somebody launches a nuclear weapon against us, we launch one back, says General Hyten. They launch another, we launch another. They launch two, we launch two. It's an escalation ladder, Hyten says. The STRATCOM commander in this scenario hustles into the underground battle deck, a 1,000-square-foot, concrete-walled room. His eyes focus on a massive electronic screen that covers almost the entire wall, a display screen the size of a movie theater screen. Three electronic clocks display three different time sequences being tracked in seconds as the attacking nuclear missile hurtles toward the United States. These time sequences are referred to as red impact. Time remaining until an incoming enemy missile arrives on target. Blue impact, time remaining until the U.S. nuclear counterattack strikes the enemy. Safe escape, time remaining for the commander to exit the bunker and escape. Here inside the bunker, the battle deck staff briefs the commander in a well-rehearsed order that wastes no time. With the red impact and safe escape clocks counting down, getting the blue impact clock running is the top priority, counterattack. At the back of the room, a soundproof divider comes down from the ceiling. It locks into place. The men and women in the battle deck maintain some of the highest security clearances in the U.S. nuclear command and control system. They rehearse launch protocols day in and day out. But the information about to be discussed is far too sensitive for anyone but a small group of STRATCOM officers to hear. The core group assembled now begins discussing launch plans. 1 minute, 30 seconds. NORAD headquarters, Peterson Space Force Base, Colorado. A little more than 9 miles northeast of Cheyenne Mountain, as the crow flies, at NORAD headquarters in Colorado, deputies, officers, and military aides run down the corridors of Peterson Space Force Base and into the NORAD NORTHCOM Command Center. The Peterson Command Center looks similar to the one inside Cheyenne Mountain, only it's bigger, designed to accommodate an ever-growing staff assigned to handle new threats. This is a central collection and coordination facility for early warning sensor data currently being received from and disseminated to mission partners in the U.S. and around the world. Nuclear command and control is predicated on the concept of redundancy, with multiple organizations performing similar tasks in the event one component fails. From inside this classified facility in the shadow of the Colorado Rockies, the NORAD commander prepares to convey his nuclear attack assessment to the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, co-located inside the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Using an encrypted EMP